Today at Reader's Corner, we talked to Christopher Ingram, author of If You Lived Here, You'd Be Home By Now, Why We Traded the Commuting Life for a Little House on the Prairie. I'm Bob Custer. Welcome to Reader's Corner. Like so many young American couples, Chris Ingram and his wife, Brianna, were having a difficult time making ends meet as they tried to raise their twin boys in the East Coast suburbs. One day, Chris, in his role as a data guy, reporter at the Washington Post, stumbled on a study that would change his life. It was a ranking of America's 3,000-plus counties from ugliest to the most scenic. He quickly scrolled to the bottom of the list and gleefully wrote the words, "The absolute worst place to live in America is, drumroll please, Red Lake County, Minnesota." The story went viral, and the reaction from the folks in Red Lake County was less than warm, to put it mildly. So how did Ingram and his family find themselves moving to that very spot just a few years later? Well, If You Lived Here, You'd Be Home By Now is the story of making a decision that turns all your preconceptions, good and bad, on their heads. It's a wry and charming tale of what happened to one family brave enough to move well beyond its comfort zone. Christopher Ingram is the reporter for the Washington Post, writing about all things data, with a particular interest in wealth, happiness, and inequality. He previously worked at the Brookings Institution and the Pew Research Center. If You Lived Here, You'd Be Home By Now is his first book. Christopher Ingram, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Hey, thanks so much for having me.
Well, I told the very beginning of the story, Chris, but you might want to give us some idea of this data set you found. I think it was the USDA data set, and just the details on what that all led to.
Yeah, this was a really cool data set that I had, I'd been working at the Post for a couple years at this point, and this is something I'd never heard of. It was called the Natural Amenities Index. And what these scientists at the USDA did is they basically took county-level data on all sorts of aspects of the physical landscape. So think hills and valleys, lakes and shorelines, as well as things about climate, winters and sunshine and summer temperatures. And they kind of mashed it all in a statistical blender to create this ranking of, places with the most natural amenities is what they called it, or a way to shorthand that would be the most natural beauty and the least. And so, at the top of the list was, a lot of places in Southern California where you've got that Mediterranean climate and the ocean and the mountains and everything, and it's all very picturesque. But the place at the bottom of the list was this little place in the middle of nowhere called Red Lake County. It was in northwest Minnesota. It's 2 hours north of Fargo, just really way off the beaten path. And it's a place that is flat. It's very hot in the summer. It is very cold in the winter. And, you kind of match all these characteristics together, and they end up dead last in the list.
And so the reaction from Red Lake Falls and Red Lake County and the state of Minnesota, it was more than just the local mayor calling you up and say, "Excuse me, I object to this," or the Chamber of Commerce. They may not even have one in Red Lake County for all I know. But
Yeah, no. And so that was really surprising. So the piece goes up at like 9:27 on a Monday morning. And by 9:32, the very polite hate mail is rolling in from Minnesota people. And it's coming in from people in Red Lake Falls and Red Lake County, but just also all over the state. And I learned that day that Minnesotans, they have a great amount of pride in their state. They're kind of like the Texas of the North. I learned that you don't mess with Minnesota because, like, everybody in the state just kind of rallied to the defense. They were just, appalled at the notion that a corner of their beautiful, great state could possibly land at the bottom of some federal beauty pageant. And this reaction was weird to me because I've, as a data reporter, I've written a lot of rankings like these on all sorts of topics. And, like 9 times out of 10, the place that ends up at the bottom of whatever list usually is someplace like Alabama or Mississippi in the Deep South, right? Like, statisticians have this phrase, "Thank God for Alabama," because Alabama is always at the bottom. And the idea is that no matter how bad your state may be in a given measure, Alabama is always worse. So I've written all sorts of awful things about Alabama and Mississippi in my career, but never heard a word of complaint from anyone in those states. And then I go and I toss one offhanded comment about a little town in Minnesota, and like literally the entire state is on flames and letting me know about it. So it was real kind of a surprise to me the way the feedback turned out.
Right. Well, give us an idea before we talk about your getting the invite to go there of just what Red Lake County is like, or Red Lake Falls, where you live. It's a town of 1,400, but tell us things like how long is Main Street, how many restaurants, how many bars, how many gas stations. What would we expect if we drove through Red Lake Falls?
Yeah, it's one of those, if you blink, you'll miss it kind of places. 1,400 people. There's not a single stoplight anywhere in the county.
Hey, that's a good deal.
Which has kind of been a challenge for my kids, because like now when we travel places with my kids who are now six and we have to stop at stoplights, they're like, what is this? Why are we stopped? This is really frustrating. But very small. You know, there are two restaurants in town which are basically bars, and they both serve, you know, essentially the same kind of food, like, you know, fried bar food. There is a little grocery store, a little local grocery store. We've got a post office. We've got a few churches. There's an elementary school and a high school. So just a classic Midwestern small town. Now, at the time I wrote this, I didn't know this. I was from upstate New York, so you know, rural life in upstate New York, where I'm from, is very different than what I've found out here. And in upstate New York, it has kind of a real Rust Belt feel. There is a sense that all the opportunities have left, that there are a lot of challenges, people are really struggling. Out here, it's not quite like that. The towns are almost Rockwellian in nature. Everything is very tidy. There's just a huge amount of social pride and social cohesion, and people really setting aside their individual concerns in order to come together for the sake of something bigger, whether it's supporting their schools or building a pool in the town or what have you. Just a very different mode of rural living out here than what I was accustomed to from the East Coast.
So you get invited out there to be proven wrong, basically. And I wonder if you could share with our listeners, first of all, your wife Brianna's first reaction to going there. And secondly, what I would call the Matt Damon-like arrival you had.
Yeah, sure. So you know, after a couple of days of this story and ongoing controversy, this guy from Red Lake County actually writes out to me. And as it turns out, he says he's a business owner in town, this guy named Jason Brumwell. And he says he owns a tubing business and a campground, and they've got a river in the county or whatever. And so they do river tubing in the summer. And he's like, hey, you should really come out and visit. We'd love to show you around, you know, get a little more attention on our town or whatever. And so, like, the first thing I do, right, is I Google Jason to make sure he's not some, like, deranged axe murderer or something like that. And, okay, no, it turns out he's a legit guy. He actually has a business. And so I tell my wife, I'm like, you know, the people in that little community, they've invited me to actually go out there and see the place. And she's like, are you kidding me? They're going to kill you. Do not go out there. That would be the dumbest thing you could possibly do at this point. And then I kind of pitched it to my editors, and my editors were like, yeah, go out there and see what happens. Because I think, you know, they were thinking that, like, you know, a Washington Post reporter gets killed by a polite Midwestern mob would be a very good kind of August story. So I go out there, you know, I have to get, you know, the closest airport is an hour away across the state line in North Dakota in Grand Forks. So I have to fly into Grand Forks. I have to rent a car. I drive out. And, you know, Jason texts me and he's like, hey, meet me up at the courthouse. We've got a couple people here who want to meet you. And then we'll kind of show you around to some places around the county or whatever. And so I drive up to the courthouse and I get out of the car. And the first thing I notice is that the marching band, they've assembled a marching band of like the high school students, the high school marching band. They're arranged on the courthouse steps and they start playing a tune. And like the mayor's there, the county commissioners are there, dozens of people are there. There are a whole bunch of like TV cameras from local news stations and regional outlets who wanted to kind of, you know, hoping for some fireworks, like to see, you know, what would happen, you know, when this Washington Post reporter finally sets foot in this place that he denigrated in the pages of one of America's finest newspapers. So it was kind of a surreal scene.
That's amazing. Well, now, obviously, you're taken on this two-day tour of everything there is to see in Red Lake County, and then you go home to tell the story to Brianna and your family, and interestingly enough, in your commutes back and forth to work, you're daydreaming.
Yeah, and so this all happens at kind of a weird time in our lives. So we were living in Baltimore. I was commuting into D.C. to go to the Post, so it was like an hour and a half one way, 3 hours a day, 15 hours a week, over a month every year I was spending during the commute, just hating every minute of it. We had just had twins. Our twins were two by this point, and they were rapidly outgrowing our house. We were living in this little tiny 800-square-foot row house. So, you know, we needed two things. We needed a bigger house and we needed to be closer to D.C. The problem was both of those things were just way out of our budget. You get closer to D.C. and mortgage and rents just skyrocket. If you go farther out to afford a better place, you know, my commute would have been two or three times as long. So we were just, we were really stuck. Brianna was working at a high-powered government job. She was at the Social Security Administration at their headquarters. And so, you know, we never saw each other during the week. We never saw the kids. We were really just coming apart at the seams. And we knew that, like, something had to change. But we just, you know, no matter how we ran the numbers or what we looked at, we just couldn't make it work. And we're kind of complaining about this to my mom one day, you know, in the months following our, that visit out to Red Lake County. And eventually she was like, well, why don't you guys just go, like, if you hate Maryland so much, like, why don't you go live in that nice little Minnesota town you visited over the summer? And we were kind of like, ha ha, yeah, that wouldn't that be funny? But then, like, you know, we kind of start thinking about it, and, like, then you're looking up home prices, and you're comparing cost of living and, like, schools and all of that stuff, and it, you know, the seed got planted. And eventually we ended up at a place where we convinced ourselves that it would have been financially irresponsible of us to not move to rural Minnesota. In the middle of nowhere. You know, we could afford a regular house. There was a nice, nice local school that we could send the kids to. And just, you know, as a data guy, it was the notion of kind of turning our lives upside down on a single data point was really kind of appealing and interesting to me. And it was kind of like, all right, well, this will be a fun experiment. Let's see what happens. And so we decided to do it.
You're listening to Christopher Ingram. He's the author of If You Lived Here, You'd Be Home By Now, Why We Traded the Commuting Life for a Little House on the Prairie. So almost any spouse can relate to the next part of this story, Chris, and that's when you have to take Brianna out to Red Lake County to show her what it's all about and to get her sign off that this makes some sense. And you do that. And I'll let you tell our listeners more about what she saw, but I definitely want you to include the part about Brutus the bear.
Oh, yeah. So, you know, we kind of talked this through, and she actually, I got her to agree to this move sight unseen. So she didn't actually come out and see the place with her own eyes until several months later when we were looking for a place to live. So one of the very important things to understand about Brianna is that she spent much of her childhood in Arizona, and she really, really, really doesn't like the cold. And so I kind of had to fudge things a bit to sell around the place. She was like, so how cold is it out there exactly? I'm like, oh, you know, it's not that much worse than upstate New York or Vermont or wherever. It's really not that bad. And it actually is that bad. It's actually way worse in those places. But I kind of fudged that a little bit. And eventually, I wrote the initial story in August. The following March, we're going out and we're looking for a place to live. And it's kind of a challenge looking for a place to live in a rural area like this because there just aren't that many people. There aren't going to be many homes on the market at any given time. There's really no rental market to speak of. But a lot of the folks in the area were really excited to hear that we were coming out, which was kind of a relief. I was kind of worried about, like, oh, they're going to be like, what are these carpetbaggers doing here? But they thought this was such a cool idea. And so they really helped us out in terms of, you know, looking for houses for sale and finding places that were being sold just kind of privately, like not listed online or anything. And we go to all these places. And one of the interesting things of that weekend was that people kept talking to us as if there were a real distinction between houses in the country and houses in town. And we were kind of confused, like, about this. We were just like, well, what do you mean, like, all of these houses are in the country? Like, this is country here. It's nothing but country for, like, 150 miles in either in any direction. But, you know, among the houses we looked at was this one place, and to get there, so you kind of had to drive outside the town of Red Lake Falls, and, like, you go to the end of the paved road, and then you turn down the dirt road, and then you go to the end of the dirt road, and then you drive down, like, whatever the less-than-dirt road is, and you arrive at this place, like, in the middle of nowhere, like, just kind of surrounded by fields and forests and everything. And it was a really cool place. They had a barn, and it was, like, there was a stream in back. And we're talking to the current owners who were trying to sell it, and they're like, yeah, it's great living out here, you know. Yeah, and just very nonchalantly, they happen to mention that, oh, you know, we keep a shotgun by the door because, you know, there's a bear that comes through here every once in a while. We call him Brutus. He's totally fine. He's totally harmless, but every once in a while, he gets a little frisky, and we have to, like, fire the gun to put him in his place. And Brianna and I were like, whoa, okay, so this is what you mean by country. Like, I get it now. I see that that is a little different than living in the town of Red Lake Falls. And I was kind of all for it. I was like, yeah, let's live with Brutus the bear. This is going to be so cool. And, you know, Brianna was really worried about, with me being a writer, getting into some kind of weird Shining-style situation where we're, like, snowed in just this remote outpost for months on end with no contact with the outside world. And she's like, nah, we're going to nix that. We're going to go in town where at least there's other people around. And if there are, you know, if there are bear attacks, we can at least call on reinforcements.
So there had to be a series of adjustments that you make when you move to a place like Red Lake County, especially if you're coming from the Baltimore suburbs. And perhaps you could help our listeners understand how you became the big game hunter of Minnesota.
Yeah. I became a big game hunter in Minnesota. So, yeah, so, you know, our first year here, we wanted to kind of experience all the things that the locals do, and just, you know, kind of live life the way they do out here. And so, you know, the Brumwell family, the Jason, the guy who invited me out here, they became very close friends of ours. And one of the things they were adamant about is that we go hunting with them, deer hunting. I had never been deer hunting before. And they've got this, a friend of theirs owns this big patch of land where they've been hunting for like 40 years, and it's just like crawling with bucks or whatever. You know, so they get me all, like, on the first day of deer season, they get me all decked out in my bright fluorescent orange. And I have to take, like, because I'm from out of state and I've never hunted in Minnesota before, I have to take, like, this remedial online hunter safety course that's like, you know, like, don't point the gun at your face and a lot of really basic stuff like that. So they're giving me a lot of grief for having to do that. But I passed my course. And so they deck me out and they outfit me with the gun. And, like, you know, I was kind of like, I was a little appalled by how early you, like, people were getting up on the first day of deer season opener. You know, we had to get up at like 4 or 5 a.m. to be out in your stands, you know, well before sunrise. And, you know, they kind of, you know, they put me in, like, they deny this, but I'm convinced that they put me in the worst stand on this property that saw absolutely no deer whatsoever. That first morning, I saw nothing, no deer. And then it took me a while. It took me several days, but eventually, I think it was one of the last days of deer season, I did end up getting a buck. And it was a weird experience because I've never, like, shot a large animal or any animal before. So it was kind of like this, you know, this kind of queasy, uncomfortable experience. And, like, it wasn't a clean kill. Like, I actually had to go and, like, you know, finish the buck off. So it was kind of, you know, it was this very kind of weird experience. And, like, you know, I shared it with the, you know, I talked to the Brumwells about it, and they just kind of joked and gave me grief and whatever, because that's just, you know, part of the experience. But it was, you know, it was definitely, like, definitely not the kind of thing that you typically do in Baltimore. So it was a real fun experience. I'm glad that I did it. It was great getting the venison afterwards, because the venison was awesome. You know, one weird thing about here, and I don't know if this is the case in Idaho where you are, but, like, cooking with venison is not a big thing. Like, the thing that they do with venison out here is they take the venison, they grind it up, and then they adulterate it with, like pork sausage. Like, and so they make the sausage just, like, half pork and half venison. So you get none of that, like, good venison gaminess or whatever. So we were trying to, like, you know, when my wife and I were trying to do all these, like, venison recipes and making venison stock or whatever, and the people just looked at us like we were crazy. Like, no, you don't make venison broth. You just turn it into sausage. So, you know, we had some of those kind of those moments of fun cultural exchange as a result of the whole deer hunting experience as well.
If you could just briefly share with us another cultural experience, building an igloo for the kids.
Yeah, so that was a lot of fun. So, you know, one of the things we've been learning to do is, so in this Natural Amenities Index, cold winters are like a bad thing, right? Because your median American person does not like, you know, being out in 40 below weather. But one of the really cool things we found about being up here is all the things that you can do in the winter that you simply can't do other places. And where I'm originally from, in upstate New York or in Maryland, you know, the temperature is never below freezing for very long. It'll dip down there, you'll get some snow, and then it'll go above freezing and the snow will melt. Out here, like, once it sinks below freezing in, like, late October or November, it just stays there. So when the snow comes, the snow literally just piles up and up and up all winter until about March or April, and it just doesn't go away. And with that kind of sustained cold, you can do all sorts of cool things. So one of the things we did, I think it was our second winter, is we got a bunch of plastic Tupperware tubs, and we put water in them, and we froze them, and we actually built our own ice block igloo out of these tubs. And it sat around for months because, like, it was cold enough to support an igloo. So, you know, this is kind of place where you can, like, build an igloo in your yard and it will stay there, and it can be part of your outdoor experience for months at a time. Or, like, you know, cross-country skiing. A lot of people are into cross-country skiing. In Maryland, you might get maybe 2 days out of the winter where the conditions are good that you can actually, like, ski anywhere near where people live. Out here, literally, you can do it from November to, like, March because it's just constant snow. It never melts. It never goes away. And, you know, I think we're trying to embrace all of these different things because it's how people out here really deal with that, those long winters and that deep, deep freeze kind of cold that you don't get in just about anywhere else in the country.
You're listening to Christopher Ingram. He's the author of If You Lived Here, You'd Be Home By Now. So let's talk a little bit about some other couple of challenges. One of them was pretty scary. I'm talking about healthcare now. When you live in a very, very small town, you're not going to be next to the kind of hospitals that you were near in Baltimore. Johns Hopkins mm-hmm. comes to mind. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if you could share with us how you dealt with that, especially in regard to the birth of your third son.
Yeah, so one of the really great things about coming out here, about moving to a low cost of living area, is that we finally had enough time and space and more financial flexibility in our lives where we could actually consider having a third child. And we decided to do that because, you know, we had the room in our lives. You know, we decided it would be a great thing to do. And so part of that, of course, is like getting good, like, you know, obstetric care and everything. And so the nearest hospital is like, I don't know, a half an hour away or something like that, whereas in Baltimore it was something like, you know, 10 minutes. So, we, you know, we had to kind of make sure, you know, we knew where we were going and have a plan for, like, where the hospital was. And everything was fine. Like, you know, it was perfectly, completely normal kind of pregnancy. But then all of a sudden, like, 6 weeks before the due date, Brianna's water broke and she went into labor just out of the blue. And we were like, oh, man, like, we didn't have time to prepare, like, you know, an overnight bag or to even, like, we hadn't even visited, like, the delivery ward or the doctors. We knew nothing about the place. So we just end up having to, like, just throw ourselves in the car, and we were able to get a hold of one of our friends here in town who could just come over and just, like, watch the kids for a few hours until we figured something else out. And we kind of had to go on this white-knuckle drive down these backcountry roads to get to the hospital, and all I remember thinking was, you know, no matter what else happens, I do not want to be delivering a six-week premature baby in the middle of a ditch in a cornfield somewhere. Like, I have to get to this hospital. So it was super stressful. You know, we ended up making it to the hospital, but of course it was a small little rural hospital. And, you know, they looked at her case and they're like, look, we're not equipped to deal with a baby who's that early. You need to go to North Dakota. You need to go to Grand Forks. So they ended up putting Bree on an ambulance, and I ended up following her all the way out there. So, you know, our son, William, we call him our Minnesota baby, but really technically he's our North Dakota baby because he was born in North Dakota. But ended up being fine. Like, he came out and, you know, he had to spend a couple of days in intensive care, but he was out and home within a few days. So it ended up in the end being just kind of a really positive experience where the care that we received out here, you know, we worried about that. Like, you know, like, what's a rural hospital going to be like? Is it just going to be like, you know, some guy's garage or something like that? But no, they have like legit medical care. The doctors took great care of Bree and of William. He came home, you know, much earlier than anyone expected. He's doing great. It has its challenges, the things like healthcare, but, you know, fortunately for us in that situation, it ended up having a happy ending.
So Brianna went on to have a new career. You might share with our listeners what happened there.
Yeah, so one of the appeals of coming out here was that one of us, and it ended up being her just because my job was much more portable than hers was, but one of us could stay home and kind of raise the twins during their early years. And so that ended up being her. And she, you know, she's a very busy, very bright, very talented person, so she likes to stay busy. So she, you know, she immediately started doing a bunch of volunteer work out here, volunteering for a local arts council and just some committees in town. But after a year or two, a seat opened up on city council, and the mayor and folks in town were like, Brianna, you should really run, because she has kind of a reputation of, you know, the kind of person who gets stuff done. And so she ran, and so now she is a member of the Red Lake Falls City Council. So it's kind of strange to think of, like, as a result of this offhanded sentence I wrote 4 years ago, like, we are now living in this place, and Brianna is making decisions to affect the trajectory of this rural community going forward into the future. So it's real, like, kind of strange butterfly effect stuff happening there.
You may be able to write a book on where she goes in politics from here. Who knows?
I don't know. Yeah, you know, I'm still getting used to being married to a politician. It's kind of for a reporter, it's kind of a strange reality. But, you know, a Red Lake Falls politician is a very different thing than a D.C. politician.
Right,
so we'll have to see how it goes for her.
So talk to us about the rural narrative that we hear so often about the loss and decline in rural America, and what you discovered in some research that a University of Minnesota professor, Ben Winchester, did regarding certain demographic groups. And I think this kind of fits in with another part of your book where you talk about numeric stereotyping and what you learned, because in a sense, you were the victim, you might say, of numeric stereotyping. If you could help us with that, I think our listeners would really enjoy knowing more about what the real America looks like.
Yeah, well, you know, I'd say I was both a victim and a perpetrator of numeric stereotyping, for sure. But one of the things that that Ben Winchester, a guy with the University of Minnesota, and some other demographers have seen is that, you know, the classic story about rural America is kids grow up, they leave, they go to the cities, and don't come back. And what they're finding, actually, in Minnesota and then some other places, too, is that, you know, that narrative holds true throughout people's 20s when they're starting their careers. You want to go someplace big like St. Paul or Minneapolis to get your foot in the door for a job. But as people hit their 30s and 40s and they settle down and they have kids, they really start to see the positive benefits of living in a smaller community, of raising your kids in a small community where everybody knows who they are. You look at survey data and you ask people in all across America, a national sample of people, where they prefer to live. Over half of Americans say that they would prefer to live in a small town or a rural area if all else were equal. And now we know that most Americans don't live in those places. Over 80% of them actually live in big cities and metro areas. So there's this huge kind of pent-up demand for, you know, living in cities and or small towns and rural areas if they had the chance. But a lot of people they're tethered to their jobs, and the cities are where the jobs are. And so in Brianna and my case, telework was kind of the key that unlocked that puzzle for us, because I was able to take my job with me. And, you know, I have heard of other people up here who do similar things. There's somebody who lives in town here who's like a graphic designer in Texas, and there are other people who live up here, but they work remotely in jobs in the Twin Cities. So I do see, even with my own eyes, like not just us, but other people up here who are taking advantage of that, who are, you know, working these city jobs, but enjoying these kind of small town amenities that you don't get in big urban areas.
Mm-hmm. I think somewhere in your book you said that as far as you're concerned, we're staying in Red Lake County, and I think you added the words for the foreseeable future. Well, what does that mean?
Yeah, no, this, I mean, this is home now, right? Like, we're not going anywhere. And it was, you know, it was kind of weird because, like, when we started out, this was kind of like an experiment. It was kind of a one-year thing. And I kind of pitched it to my editors. I was like, all right, you know, let's try this for a year and see what happens. And if it's not working out, I'll come back or whatever. But we're going into year four now, and we're still here. And, like, our kids, the older kids, this is all they know. They've had more birthdays out here now than they have in Maryland. And so they're in first grade at the school. They have, you know, all these friends at school. The kids are enmeshed in the community. My wife and I are enmeshed in the community. She's on city council. So this is home. So everybody always asks us, like, oh, when are you leaving? When are you leaving? And, you know, we're at a point where we're like, well, we're not. Like, this is home for us. We are putting down roots here. You know, we moved around so much in our 20s, like so many couples do. And we've really kind of settled on this place as, you know, this is where we are and this is where we want to be.
One of the things that's so charming about your book is the way you have managed to tell not only your story and Brianna's and the kids, but the stories of those people you've met who have become good friends and neighbors and who have had so much fun acclimating you to the culture and life in a small town. The Brumwells come to mind. And in the acknowledgments, you give a shout out to them. What are they thinking that you've put them in this book that is being read across the nation? I mean, I assume if I walk down Main Street, I'm not going to get very far without seeing a copy of your book somewhere, even if you don't have a bookstore.
So there is no bookstore here. The closest one is in North Dakota, actually. But yeah, you know, so what I've heard most from the overwhelming majority of people around here is people – they tell me that they're so happy that this book is helping shine a light on this corner of the country, which is really kind of a forgotten corner of the country, like Northwest Minnesota. Like, nobody ever talks about Northwest Minnesota. So people are really kind of happy that they're kind of in the spotlight and that the book kind of shares what's special about their community. And I think one thing helpful that the book has done for a lot of folks around here is, you know, when you live in a community, and this is true of anywhere, cities, small towns, whatever, but when you live in a place and you've been enmeshed into a place for a while, and you kind of lose track of what's special in the place because it's just like, you know, it turns into the air that you breathe or whatever. And so I think for out here, in a place where, you know, you don't have a lot of people from outside coming in and talking about it or whatever, the experience of having somebody, just a complete outsider, come in and look at this place with fresh eyes and be able to talk about the things that are really special and really cool about this place, I think it's been good for the community and helping, you know, kind of reaffirm why so many of the folks stay here and why they like it here and what is truly special about this place.
Well, you've done an excellent job. I must say that it's one of the most enjoyable books I've read in a long time. And in addition to the personal story, I just learned so much more about America and about the people in rural America in particular. So I want to commend you for that. It's an honest, funny book that really covers from A to Z what it's like living in rural America. I want to thank you, Chris Ingram, for joining us today. It's the book, If You Lived Here, You'd Be Home By Now, Why We Traded the Commuting Life for a Little House on the Prairie. Thanks so much, Chris.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a lot of fun.
Reader's Corner is presented by Boise State Public Radio News. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones. Research and production by Joel Wayne. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.